Q-Nibbly at Claremont, a presentation by Boyd J. Peterson.
Well, first I wanted to just give you a little bit of background as to the setting for this little discussion. Hugh Nibley had just graduated from Berkeley, and it was at the end of 1939 when Europe was on the verge of war, and Germany was becoming more and more aggressive, and the United States was remaining neutral. After World War I, most Americans felt the nation shouldn't get involved in any kind of war. Besides, America had its own problems with the Great Depression. The Depression brought in its wake, which is a really sad and telling point in American history, a resurgence of anti-Semitism across the world, including America. The America First Committee, which was created in July of 1940, lobbied hard to keep the United States out of any European entanglements, but it also subscribed to a philosophy of militant anti-Semitism. Many of its supporters, including Father Charles Coughlin, Henry Ford, and the nation's hero, Charles Lindbergh, delivered hate-filled speeches against the supposed Jewish conspiracy controlling banking and government and the motion picture industry. From the Depression years through World War II, anti-Semitism had never been worse in the United States, nor would it be again, according to one source. Thus, while Hitler was preparing for his final solution for the Jews and other social undesirables, Americans were retreating into a defiant xenophobia, insisting that the nation's social and economic problems were serious enough that the country should not be meddling in problems abroad. Ironically, and Roosevelt probably realized this, it was America's full industrial mobilization for World War II that finally ended the Depression. For Hugh Nibley, the conflict in Europe was personal. He'd given 2 years of his life to his mission in Germany, and even though he'd been unsparingly critical of German materialism and religious indifference, his love for the language, culture, and people was unfeigned. He also retained many friends in church branches where he had served. Undoubtedly, the events in Europe caused a great internal conflict for Hugh Nibley. He was torn between his mixed feelings for Germany and the German people, concern for the saints, the dread of involvement in a conflict that would certainly disrupt his life and perhaps kill him, uneasiness with the virulent anti-Semitism around him, an ancestral connection to the beleaguered British Isles, and sympathy with the American desire to stand aloof from continental problems. In a letter to his friend Paul Springer, which was written around 1939, it's undated, Hugh stated his position about the, quote, international situation, which he said was like that of most Americans. "I remain neutral," wrote Hugh, "but more against the Allies than the Germans." By 1942, after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in December of 41, Hugh had changed his mind. On September 28th, he enlisted in the U.S. Army. Given his knowledge of Germans, he should have been able to predict that he'd be sent to the European theater. Hugh's attitudes about Jews were even more complicated. His mother's mother was half-Jewish, or his father's mother, rather, was half-Jewish. And so Hugh would have been considered Jewish under Hitler's Nuremberg Law of 1935. For Hugh's mother, her children's Jewish ancestry was both a source of pride and shame. She was proud in the Mormon context that the Niebuhrs had been among the first Jews to accept the gospel, but she was also jealous of the gifted Jewish children in the Los Angeles area where they were growing up. "I think mother had a fixation about Jewish children," states Reed Nibley, Hugh's brother, "that her boys could be just as well known and do just as well as any of these little Jewish boys. And she didn't realize that we were little Jewish boys." Reed states that Sloane wouldn't openly acknowledge her son's Jewish ancestry most of the time. She had problems with that, says Reed. She definitely had a problem. Yet simultaneously, she'd go around pinching your nose to make it better, bigger, more Jewish. This incoherent attitude must have affected the sons on some level, giving them a love-hate relationship with their own heritage. Hugh's best friend, Paul Springer, was every bit as schizophrenic in his attitudes. His right-wing, borderline fascist politics led him to sympathize with the Germans during the period just before the United States entered the war. He was a Nazi, Hugh says, and with that political stance came very strong anti-Semitic rhetoric. He was sort of faking it most of the time, remembered Hugh, but he poured it on. He couldn't stand the Jews. He hated Jews. He made a big show of it. Nevertheless, Hugh recalls that Springer's attitude didn't stop him from having many friends who were Jewish. Occasionally, some of the same anti-Semitic rhetoric that was passing through the nation and which he heard from his mother and his best friend would pop up in Hugh's letters to Paul. While Hugh was never as extreme as his mother or Paul Springer, he certainly certainly never came close to the kind of invective that was heard from the likes of Father Coughlin, Charles Lindbergh, and Henry Ford. It's still startling to come across some of the views that he shared, that he had at this time, which are at such a marked variance with those of his more mature self. He once referred to, quote, the Jewish question as largely aesthetic, since the Jews take any dialect and turn it into a thing of sheer unloveliness. That was in a letter in 1940. In another letter, he quipped that the Germans hated Jews while he liked them because, quote, unlike Poles attract each other and like Poles repel each other. He quickly added, paradoxically, I promise immediate violence to the unfortunate who mistakes me for one of them. In 1939 or 1940, Hugh stated rather dismissively that he would endure Jews willingly if they would manage somehow to either, one, remember their religion, or two, forget their race. So far, all their effort is in the opposite direction. However, his keen eye did not miss the hypocrisy inherent in the German anti-Jewish crusade, and he delighted in pointing out such inconsistencies. In one letter, he joked that the German swastika was a variant of the Star of David, while the German outstretched arms salute was passed down from the hand of God greeting of the ancient Hebrews. He amusingly said that a, quote, poisonal friend was working at the Copenhagen City Archives when Joseph Paul Goebbels, Hitler's minister of propaganda, who had Danish ancestry, was told that his genealogy could be found not in the city archives, but at a synagogue. By 1942, Hugh's attitudes toward Jews had moved in a markedly tolerant direction. In March, after receiving an anti-Semitic letter from his mother, he wrote sternly, "Your polemic on the Jews is very depressing." He assured her, based on inside information, that the Jewish presence in the war was every bit as great and every bit as dedicated as the Allies, and concluded, "I beg of you to let up on that hysterical theme." Although there's no record of how his mother took this rebuke, there's nothing more that could be considered even remotely anti-Semitic in Hugh's correspondence after this period. This change in attitude resulted from first-hand conversations he had with exiled Germans about the realities of Hitler's Germany and with some of Germany's most influential and gifted Jews about the lethal realities of German anti-Semitism. This opportunity came not from living in Germany, but from teaching at the small campuses of Claremont colleges. When Hugh was hired in 1939, the campus consisted of Pomona College Scripps, which was the private liberal arts college for women, and Claremont Graduate School. It was a very small school, remembered Hugh, only 800 students. Mind you, so we got to know each other pretty well there. The graduate school was even smaller. We only had about 100 students. So after Hugh graduated from Berkeley in 1938, he sought employment at Claremont Colleges. When he approached the school president, Russell Story, about teaching, he evidently was met with some resistance. And Hugh says that he actually volunteered teaching here for no fee. He worked for free for the first year. I have no way to find that out, though, because the payroll records were not preserved. So I'd still like to find out the truth of that one. During this period when Hugh had very little or no income, he evidently subsisted on oranges which would drop off trees around Claremont and cabbage that cost only a few pennies in the stores. This was a typical thing for him to kind of eat, to just kind of sustain himself on things that weren't that expensive. The reality of this is that that modifies this picture some is that his mother would come up to Claremont from the Hollywood area every so often, every couple of weeks, and bring Hugh a bag of food and clean laundry, and then she'd drive back with his laundry and the kids, just like she'd done while he was a graduate student at Berkeley. Hugh was not known for kind of taking care of himself. Barbara, who turned 13 in 1939, like Reed remembers, driving over to Claremont from Hollywood with her mother to, quote, pick up Hugh's dirty clothes and clean out the wilted old cabbage leaves, orange and grapefruit pills, and other odds and ends that were lying about. She'd take the clothes home, wash them, and then take them back and clean out the old wilted cabbage leaves again. The fastidious mother must have been beside herself, both because of Hugh's slovenliness, but also because of the death-defying disregard for nutrition. Barbara said, I don't think he bothered to cook anything. He just lived on raw whatever. Probably beginning in the fall of 1940, Hugh was employed as a lecturer in history and social philosophy. At Pomona, he taught modern European history. At Scripps, he taught humanities. And at the graduate school, he taught U.S. history, the history of education, Greek, and German. In a letter to Paul Springer during that academic year, Hugh, who had taken to referring to himself in the first-person plural, which was a sort of mockery, I think, of academic affectation, reported his heavy schedule. We are in a state of a total dither. Our first class meets at 7:30 a.m., from which until noon I talk at an ever-accelerating speed until the torrid finale sounds like the whirlwind finish of Apastonia. I'm giving, for example, a five-week cram course in the intellectual history of the Western world and find that the only way to cover the ground is to exhaust the subject, myself and my students, at the rate of one century per day. After one of these bouts, I feel as if I have done a month on a rock pile, and there's another century coming up for tomorrow. This fantastic schedule runs 6 days a week. Hugh also became an active member of the local LDS branch, which met at the Women's Ebel Club on Holt Avenue in Pomona. According to one member of that branch, only three of its 98 members were inactive. All the others would either show up for meetings or send a reason for their absence. On Hugh's first day in the branch, Sunday school teacher Jack Smith noticed the new face and assumed Hugh was no more than a high school senior. He looked very young at that age. Wanting to make him feel welcome, the instructor decided to draw him into the discussion with a simple question. The lesson was about sin, so the teacher asked Hugh, "What is sin?" Which the lesson manual evidently defined succinctly as the transgression of the law. Hugh seemed to draw in a slight breath, remembered this ward member, leaned back and gave a complete dissertation on sin, laws, and human behavior. Brother Smith choked and watched his whole easy lesson go up in smoke. That evening, Hugh spoke in sacrament meeting. He had so much to tell us, remembers this member, that when he couldn't get it out in English, he'd quote from the original language and translate for our benefit. The small branch listened half-baffled, half-amazed, as Hugh delivered a treatise that would qualify for a college course. Soon the young branch let Hugh teach Sunday school, and every Sunday thereafter, Hugh would, quote, wheedle an exceedingly heavy and unreliable bicycle through air as bright and hot as the cozy confines of an electric furnace to Pomona to cozen the sodden minds of a wilting Sunday school class. This is a letter he wrote to Paul. Then return to Claremont, which is 1,000 feet higher than Pomona, by the same lovely conveyance. The branch soon grew accustomed to Hugh's intellectual excursions and learned to accept his sometimes cutting wit. On one occasion, when a man walked up to the podium to give the invocation, Hugh noticed he was chewing gum. With eyebrows furrowed like he was taking aim on a grizzly bear, says the same ward member, he drew in his breath like the near whistle of a boiling tea kettle and hissed, "If the prophet Joseph Smith had known about chewing gum in his day, it would have been in the Word of Wisdom." Hugh's intellectual breath and witty repartee likely fared better at Claremont than they did in the ward. Russell Story, the president of Claremont, came to admire and enjoy Hugh's company, and Hugh in turn greatly admired Story. Story was an intellectual in his own right and a professor of political science. He graduated from Monmouth College in Illinois and received his PhD from Harvard, and he taught at Clark University in Massachusetts and several other schools in the Midwest before he was appointed at Pomona. He was described as an able teacher whose questioning mind, at its best in seminar discussion, stimulated thought and independent work. In 1937, Story received a two-year leave from Pomona College to serve as acting president of the Claremont Colleges, a post he assumed in full in 1939. In this position, Story made important contributions in the establishment of graduate work, particularly in social sciences. Hugh remembers Story as, quote, a wonderful man, a great man. In fact, he called him one of the greatest men he ever knew. Hugh believes Story created a strong intellectual climate at Claremont and that was always open, honest, and effectual. In November 1941, after Hugh had been teaching for about 2 years, he wrote to his mother, quote, "As long as Story waves, truth will go for more than appearances here at least, but for the rest of the land, opportunism, exploitation, and inertia remain the rule." Not only was Story a capable scholar, but he was a very effective administrator. He initiated and organized, and it always worked, remembered Hugh. He was the type of administrator that you need, very self-effacing. Hugh also credits Story with getting some very impressive intellectual talent at Claremont. However, Story's achievement might be more realistically appraised as his ability to seize a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. As a result of the Nazi takeover in Germany, many scholars, Jews and others critical of Hitler's Reich, were forced to flee, many of them to American universities. Some eminent German scholars gained permanent positions at Claremont. Others visited Claremont to give lectures. Their presence energized Hugh Nibley. We used to have people like Thomas Mann and the like come to visit us. Dr. Einstein would give a lecture. During Thomas Mann's visit, the novelist reported on his work in progress, Joseph in Egypt, and Hugh remembers him talking about that novel and how he was going to finish it. With many of the German émigrés at Claremont, it was perhaps inevitable that some would turn out to be spies, but Hugh expressed disgust at their ineptness rather than concern. In the spring of 1942, he reported to Paul Springer that two of my particular friends on the script staff turn out to be big-time Nazi agents, a fact that perhaps three people at Claremont hadn't already suspected steadily for the past 2 years. As spies go, these two are prize ninnies. I could carry it off more subtly in darkest Japan. Another source of intellectual talent came from the many scholars who retired to Southern California and taught part-time in their fields. On at least two occasions, Hugh co-taught classes with eminent retired professors. For 4 years at Claremont, I taught a course alternately with Everett Dean Martin. He'd teach on Tuesdays and I on Thursdays. Martin was the founder of the Cooper Union School, a college for underprivileged in New York, and as Hugh put it, a great student on the Constitution. He says, "We taught absolutely opposite points of view." Hugh recalls Story confessed to Hugh that he was specifically arranged for this so that they'd balance each other out because, quote, "Martin was extreme right-wing and I could be as left-wing as I wanted and we just canceled each other out." At Scripps, Hugh taught humanities on alternating days with Edgar Goodspeed, a famous New Testament scholar who'd retired from the University of Chicago. On another occasion, Hugh attended the party celebrating the 80th birthday of German Egyptologist George Steindorf, who had retired to the Claremont area. Hugh considered Steindorf the dean of all Egyptologists. You also met many celebrity intellectuals who came specifically to speak to the Committee on War Objectives and Peace Aims, which was financed by the Rockefeller Foundation and based at Claremont. These meetings were usually held in Story's living room. Hugh, who was by this time skilled in taking shorthand from a post-high school shorthand class, attended these private meetings as their secretary. We'd sit around and wisely discuss with some pretty high-powered people, Hugh recalls. However, Hugh retained a tempered skepticism about intellectualism for its own sake. After describing Steindorf's party to his mother, Hugh summarized with flamboyant understatement, "It's not uninteresting to pass muster among the highest men in the field," but commented, "Awful vanity, let us temper it with the gospel, that a man is only worth what he produces. So far, I rate zero." A year earlier, Hugh had expressed a more jaundiced view to Paul Springer, confessing that he was dead sick of these textbook humanists, these émigrés with the big names or worse than the others, humbugs for the most part. Hugh also reported one experience that underscores the lack of esteem he could expect to find for his own interest in Mormon scholarship. Frances Hart Breasted, the widow of James Henry Breasted, the distinguished Egyptologist who founded the Oriental Institute in Chicago, lived next door to Hugh. "And since we both rode bicycles, we got to be pretty good friends," Hugh relates. Mrs. Breasted told him that her husband had once decided, quote, "to do the world a good deed and save a lot of people from the trouble of mixing themselves up and getting confused in their ignorance and hopelessness by taking a few hours and going through the Book of Mormon," and that was all it would take, a few hours, "and showing them that it was a fraud." Hugh asked Mrs. Breasted what happened to her husband's public service. Her reply was that he just dropped it, that was all. Hugh energetically attended academic conferences and began publishing academic articles. During the Christmas holidays of 1940, Hugh read a paper entitled "The Origin of the Roman Dole" at the annual meeting of the Pacific Coast Branch of the American Historical Association at Stanford. In April of 41, he attended conferences in Oakland and Berkeley. Also in 41, he read a paper entitled "Acclamatio" at the annual convention for the Southwest Archaeological Foundation in San Diego. The paper discussed the politics of ancient mobs, a topic he originally researched for his dissertation, but his committee forced him to table. The library at Claremont was not yet up to the standards Hugh had enjoyed as a college student at Berkeley, so he'd occasionally bicycle off to UCLA or Berkeley to look up sources. In June of 41, he wrote to Springer, "Last Monday, for the sake of checking up on one little footnote and a bit of exercise, I cycled into UCLA, over 50 miles from here, against a strong headwind, and in a little more than 3 hours. Thus, we wisely atone for long periods of completely sedentary work by violent fits of overexertion." Hugh had actually purchased a car the year before, but no doubt wartime rationing of gasoline was another incentive to keep using the bicycle. Hugh had not lost his childhood faculty of becoming so absorbed in his work as to lose all track of external reality, a gift he retained all his life, a gift and a curse. He wrote to his mother on his 32nd birthday, "I've been working very hard on a number of projects, and so pull myself out of old stuff only with the greatest of difficulty. It is an atmosphere that envelopes you like a dream and is very hard to shake for a few minutes while you're trying to write something like this." Hugh's efforts began to pay off as he began to see his work published in scholarly journals. The Classical Journal, a publication of the Classical Association of the Midwest and South, published two essays by Hugh, the first a short piece, "A New Light on Scaliger," responding to an early article, and Joseph Justus Scaliger, the Italian-born physician and scholar of the 16th century, had this encyclopedic knowledge which caused Hugh to refer to him somewhat extravagantly as the greatest scholar who ever lived. Hugh noted three facts about his intellectual hero that had apparently escaped the notice of previous scholars. First, from reading some Arabic script in a contemporary portrait of Scaliger, Hugh determined that the scholar's name was pronounced with a hard G rather than the then-accepted soft J. Second, contrary to tradition, Scaliger was not a self-taught recluse but had sought out some of the finest teachers of his time. And third, even in Scaliger's day, he had a reputation for being, quote, a bottomless pit of learning and a sun among the learned. Hugh had long admired Scaliger not only for his intellectual breadth, but also for his deep humility. When Scaliger was learning Hebrew, Hugh says, he went to the ghettos and the children made fun of him, correcting his Hebrew. Meanwhile, scholars wouldn't speak to him. They were indignant, Hugh summarizes. Anyone who would allow himself to be taught at all by children and corrected by children was just not worthy of their profession. Unless you become as a little child, you're not intelligent, you see. You're stupid. They blocked it because of their haughtiness, their pride, and that pride is stupidity. It was Scaliger's willingness to humiliate himself and become as a little child in order to learn that Hugh admired and which he himself would emulate in his own language studies. A second essay published by the Classical Journal was Sperasones, meaning to spread about or to sprinkle, as in Catholic baptism. Summarizing research from Hugh's dissertation, the article discussed the ancient Roman practice of throwing small gifts to the masses to be scrambled for in scenes of wild disorder. In August of 1942, Hugh jubilantly announced to Paul Springer that this article, which he had redundantly called My Grand Magnum Opus, had been accepted for publication in 1944. Just think what things will be by then, with the world rushing from worse to worse in the meantime, he mused. In fact, the article would not appear in print until 1945, after Hugh had seen firsthand the worst the world could offer. While at Claremont, Hugh continued to hone his language skills. His office calendar for May of 1941 notes his systematic rotation through texts in Latin, Hebrew, Egyptian, Greek, and Arabic. But he also continued to learn new languages. In June of 1941, he wrote to Springer, "I've made a considerable dent in Irish." In early 42, he was not only going to town on Egyptian, but, quote, Babylonian was thawing out nicely. In March of 42, he was, quote, getting my hand in at Russian and speak rather fair Italian. The next year in June, he claimed, in this country, Southern California, it's impossible not to learn Spanish, which I have come to speak, I flatter myself, rather fluently. Although he certainly concentrated on the bookish aspects of language learning, Hugh also took considerable pains to seek out native speakers. And he rejoiced in the war's silver lining that it brought immigrants to California. Starving Syrians, Greeks, and Hebrews are foregathering in great numbers in these parts and are commanding their services at a figure low enough not to strain our still pedestrian economy, he wrote to Springer in 1941. Somewhat extravagantly, he claimed to his mother that he was able to learn more about, quote, the mind and speech of the gorgeous East in the bosom of Claremont than I could ever learn in the slums of Beirut. Although these immigrants were probably looked down on in rarefied academic circles, and there is, in fact, no way of knowing what social level of language Hugh learned from them, his diligence was unflagging. He reported to Springer that he had attached himself like a leech to a Syrian named Lawand. He only speaks Arabic and recites endlessly from the Quran and an enormous repertoire of Bedouin songs and tales. In 1940, Hugh even bought a car, quote, just so I could satisfy Lawand's insatiable yearnings for desert places, for any dry gully or rocky hillside where he can feel like an Arab. You get him out in the open and he'll start reciting and singing and wailing like a Majnun, editing each verse with a long and often very enlightening commentary on the customs and manners that gave rise to it. Every rock is a quotation, every plant a memory, every odor a song. With satisfaction, Hugh reported the results of these immersion sessions. English, he said, sounds so flat and brittle and even foreign after a few hours in Lawandian recitative. He also joked that he exhausted his tutor. I find it useful with my Syrian tutor to let him take 3 deep breaths after the bucket of water has revived him before continuing the lesson and to relax my questioning whenever he shows signs of impending hysterics. He was apparently sincere in telling Springer that the car was primarily a means to enhance his language study, for he also explained to his mother, It was the means of establishing contact and ingratiating myself with various Orientals, mostly Lebanese, living throughout the valley. Before enlisting in the army in 1942, Hugh sold his, quote, powerfully throbbing Dodge, already used when he bought it. It had suffered somewhat at his hands. In 1941, when he broke off the key in the door lock, he broke the window to get in and never bothered to repair it, claiming, "It runs better, I find, with a broken window." When Lawand was not available, Hugh frequented the home of an Arabic-speaking family named Simon, who are the cutest peasants with the cutest daughters — he was still single at this time — you would care to meet. He was so dedicated to learning Arabic that in the summer of 1942, he actually moved to a different apartment where he could be nearer one of his Arabic tutors, of who Hugh wrote, "Nothing else matters when he starts talking. Every sukun, every hamza," I don't speak Arabic, so I'm guessing here, every tanween is there with a full, soulful enjoyment which makes you want to weep. I now understand him perfectly when he talks. It only remains to learn how to answer him in kind. Oddly enough, Hugh never studied Far Eastern languages, even though Claremont had been investing a great deal of scholarship in Japanese and Chinese cultures since 1929. Russell Story himself taught courses on political problems in Eastern Asia, and Hugh acknowledged, "There is a great emphasis laid at this institution on Eastern culture, for which we have a really splendid library," but he chose to concentrate on Western civilization. "I've always maintained that it's enough for a man to understand his own culture, which in the case of our own composite heritage is an overwhelming task." Despite his absorption in teaching and studying, Hugh, who turned 30 in the spring of 1940, was aware of and dissatisfied with his bachelorhood. In late 1940, he preened himself, "This is news. I have become a ladies' man." It started out when my advances to a highly respectable young woman were received not at all coldly. So I decided I should get married, since dames ingenious enough to go for little me don't grow on trees. He did not bother to propose to this unnamed young woman, however, since he discovered that other women were also interested in him. Bemusedly, he claimed, "Now we are running about with the hottest numbers in town. We take long hikes, we attend concerts, we swim in reservoirs, we eat at Tony joints, and lo, there are plenty of beauties to attend us. So now I'm wondering, why bother to marry the first one? It is a pleasant confusion." By early 1941, still in a mood for high exaltation, Hugh chanted the hymn to Hymen, classical god of marriage. "Hymen, O Hymene," he says, "who knows but what I shall get married one of these days? Who knows who, ignorance, thy ubiquity is widespread?" And in April of 1941, Hugh announced jubilantly to Paul Springer, "It has finally happened. I am formally, legally, ritually engaged to be married." His fiancée was a 27-year-old German immigré named Herta Polly, whom Hugh described as petite, exquisite, an incredible combination of unaffected elegance and volcanic energy, and absolutely perfect in all respects, allowing for a pardonable sympathy with the German cause in the present debacle. Herta, who was teaching at Scripps, had taken Greek from Hugh at the graduate school. Hugh wrote that the wedding day would be sometime in December and signed the letter, "Love and Kisses from an Expert, H.N., Junker to be by marriage." Still, the engagement was short-lived. Hugh found himself ultimately unable to tolerate Herta's Nazi sympathies. Furthermore, she was a Lutheran. But most decisively, he lost patience with her temperament. On 21 November, Hugh abruptly wrote his mother, "The affair, Polly, is washed up, and that's that." He did not elaborate. However, in a letter to Paul Springer in the spring of 1942, Hugh added a few details. "Sturm und Drang, 24 hours a day of it, with my Teutonic passion flower. It got very tedious. We called it off. She's utterly wonderful, but as you know, I'm a person of definite limitations." Hugh bounced back from the breakup, and at almost the same time, in March of 1942, he ecstatically wrote Springer about his, quote, latest passion flower that I swear that is the true one. A young Arab woman named Hind Abdunur, who he described as a full moon of beauty, more sweet and complacent and wise than Scheherazade herself. Despite Hugh's assurance that this woman was the true one, the relationship came to nothing. Meanwhile, the Nibley family fortunes had taken a decided turn for the worse. His family had been quite wealthy here in the California area. Although his father and mother had continued to live lavishly throughout most of the Depression, their finances were not stable. Despite the ill-fated mining venture that his father had had in 1936 that swallowed his fellowship money, he'd been granted a fellowship and his mother asked him to loan the money to his father for this mining venture and it went sour. Several ventures did pay off, however, and Hugh remembers that Paul Springer's father, who was then director of the U.S. Mint in San Francisco, told him that one of his father's mining ventures sent in $20,000 to $30,000 worth of gold every week. So they did all right, says Hugh, but Dad was ripped off. He was always playing pranks on people and having tricks played on him. He wasn't meant to be a businessman at all. Although the stock market crash of October 29, it wasn't until a decade later that the Nibley fortune finally vanished. On November 29th of 1938, a notice of default was filed about the Nibley house on Normandy Avenue, showing that his father and mother were not keeping up on their mortgage payments. 8 months later, a trustee's deed transferred the house from Sloney to Management Guarantee Company. The next step was a forced sale at auction of the house and the furniture. They had this huge house in the L.A. area. It was one of the first houses that had an elevator. It was just vast, but they lost it all. In 1941, in a letter to his grandmother, Hugh described his mother, Sloney, moving all their effects into a nearby garage for storage, and he added critically that it was not an unmixed evil to have Sloney's whirlwind tempo checked by worsening arthritis. I cannot without qualification accept her view of life as a perpetual blitzkrieg. Hugh took the family's financial collapse without any hand-wringing, even though he was co-signing on some of the co-signing on some undefined document with his mother having to do with the old house, and that required him to pay $133 that he could ill afford. In a letter to his mother in November of 1941, he reported making the payment and added, "Hope that's the last of it." It's not clear what the documents were that he'd co-signed, nor does Hugh remember. Sloney apparently then sought his advice on purchasing a smaller home, and Hugh replied, "You're asking the wrong person for financial advice, but I must say, if you'd be paying no more than rent anyway, what could you lose? Of course, it's a real obligation, and paying for houses is one thing we've hardly proven to be our favorite sport." Although Hugh was stoic, Sloney was shattered. With Mother, it was a very, very difficult thing to lose all that, remembers Hugh's sister Barbara. She was a beautiful woman. She married a well-known, handsome man into a family that was already wealthy. She had everything, all that money she wanted to spend, beautiful jewels, beautiful paintings, beautiful everything. And when it was lost, I think it really embittered her. The family moved to a much smaller house on Winona Boulevard, and Sloney began to sell hearing aids. Hugh's father, L, spent the rest of his life trying to mount one unsuccessful get-rich scheme after another. The relationship between Sloney and L was so strange that although they never divorced, they remained apart for much of the rest of their lives, often in different cities. Less than 2 weeks after this incident, Hugh offered Sloney his view on buying a house. Less than 2 weeks after he offered his view on buying a house, the lives of all Americans were decisively changed when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on 7 December 1941. Germany's unexpected declaration of war on the United States 3 days later effectively ended all discussion about whether the United States would enter the war. The draft was instituted, and the first registration of men ages 21 to 35 took place on October 16th. Now, 30-year-old Hugh would have been included in this group, and the first national lottery was held on October 29th to determine the order in which they'd be drafted. Hugh had applied for a deferment based on his age, but as of June 1941, he'd received no word from Uncle Sam, not even a questionnaire, he says. The next month, he added, "For some reason, the local draft board seems to have taken a shine or a violent aversion to me. I cannot tell which. At any rate, they are stubbornly averse to deferring me, even though I'm safely beyond the 28-year mark, and seem determined to see what I look like in a uniform." Reinforcing the suspense about his draft status, came a personal loss with professional consequences. On March 26th of 1942, the day before Hugh turned 32, Russell Story died of a massive heart attack. Hugh lamented to his mother, "The only strictly honest man I have ever known, President Story, died last night of a stroke. I find the circumstances significant. Suppose I shall soon be moving on." He added, "I hear a report that I have been reclassified in the local draft board to 1A. Hugh felt that he would no longer be welcome at Claremont because, he says, "I couldn't keep my feet out of the gospel. I couldn't leave the gospel alone. I had to drag in the scriptures no matter what, no matter what I was teaching, and that would sometimes get raised eyebrows." Other faculty members felt that Hugh's religious perspectives were just not quite appropriate at Claremont. The Claremont Board of Fellows decided not to immediately appoint a successor to Story, instead named Robert Bernard as Claremont's administrative director. Hugh got along famously with Bernard, but there was another administrator, he doesn't remember his exact name, but he thinks it was Bird, knew not Israel, as he put it. Bird approached him after Story's death and told him, "You know, you're not one of us." He says, "I could feel the tension growing," in a considerable understatement. A month later, Hugh wrote that he'd been investigating his options of enlistment and had concluded, "I have rather a good lineup with the government. My only care," he continued gloomily, "is what's to be done with all these books." By late May, the uncertainty was beginning to tell, and he complained, "The war has brought everything in Claremont to very nearly a dead stop. Since Story went, there's little interest in the place. Right now I'm working desperately to make the most of the lull between two storms. The school is washed up and the war is waiting." His attitude was more resignation to the inevitable than patriotic fervor for the war. As late as June 1941, he had written tellingly to Paul, "The astounding alignments in the present debacle all but forbid one to take sides." In June of 1942, however, Hugh resigned his position at Claremont. He wrote to Paul Springer later that month, "As you no doubt know, the war has simply decapitated the education business, especially the graduate field. A few weeks ago, the president of this institution died, the only thoroughly honest man I've ever known. And that was the final inducement for me to break ties with Claremont. Like you, I am now in a moment of ambrosial serenity, but without the slightest doubt that the storm is shortly to follow, a la Beethoven's Sixth." Hugh had not firmly decided on a course of action, for he speculated in the same letter, "If I didn't hate boats and get strange diseases on the water, I'd join the Navy. It might be wiser to dicker with various government agencies, but I strongly feel that salvation does not lie in that direction. Come what may, our concern is to do the right thing and let the opportunists do the smart thing. In the end, we shall see which course is the wiser." Paul, his friend, had recently married, and though still in suspense, Hugh wrote in a letter in July urging him and his wife, Nell, to join him on a trip to Zion's National Park in southern Utah. "Verily, he who placed before our feet the great expanses, literally stretched out," he writes, deserts, and they are full of sand and plant and animal creatures without number, and they are creeping and running and flying in the air, in his letter he wrote. The trip turned out to be a calm and rejuvenating vacation for Hugh. He was back in the Utah wilderness that he'd come to, and the solitude welcome and impressive. A few days later, he wrote, "Still in Zion, it is very hard to tear away from these burning rocks, so we're doing it by degrees." After this trip, Hugh happily wrote to Paul, "We have explored pretty well in the last decades of days that bright and happy, albeit narrow, vale in which our opinions do not clash." From his return from Zion, Hugh found that the draft board, quote, "is still marking time and the whole situation is as ever teeming with quiet fun." Even though men from age 28 up were deferred from the draft between August 1941 and September 42, Hugh had turned 31 in March of 1941, finally took matters into his own hands. On September 28th of 1942, he enlisted in the U.S. Army and was inducted at Fort MacArthur, about 10 miles west of Long Beach. The wait was over. From the ivory towers of the academy, Hugh was marching out to confront the storms of war. Thank you.
Our time is just about up, but we probably have maybe 5 minutes for questions, if anyone has any questions. And if you could just
sorry about that.
Repeat the questions into the microphone.
Okay.
The guy that we haven't had letters from, or?
Paul Springer was Hugh's closest friend. They met at Berkeley, and they were really very sharp contrast to each other. Paul Springer was a very far-right person. Hugh was very far-left politically. Paul Springer was not Mormon. Hugh was very much a straight-line Mormon. Paul Springer he served as the bootlegger for the kids at Berkeley. Hugh was just this straight arrow. In terms of just where they sit in every way, they were so completely opposite. But they both had very similar interests in terms of academic study, and they found that they shared a great deal that way. And Hugh seemed, all of his best friends were people who he completely disagreed with politically and ideologically and almost every way. It seemed to really find a great deal of enjoyment in that kind of conflict of opinions.
And are there other stashes of letters, or that guy happened to keep all of them?
We were very fortunate. Paul Springer kept all his letters and gave them to my brother-in-law when they were working on the film Faith of an Observer, and so we got that stash of letters. All the letters that Hugh wrote Paul, the letters that Paul wrote Hugh have disappeared. So I don't have very many of those. I've got a few, but not very many.
Anybody else who's writing like that?
Not as much as Paul. They were really close friends. I mean, he had other close friends, but Paul became somebody from the period they met at Berkeley through about 1984. They corresponded with some regularity. So it was lovely to have that correspondence. Yeah. Yeah, they do interview him in the film. Yeah. Incidentally, he died before I started the book, and so I didn't get to interview Paul, and I was very disappointed, and I tried to contact relatives, couldn't find anybody. After the book came out, it was just this year, I got an email from somebody named Paul Springer, which really surprised me, and it was Paul Springer's son, and so we've since come into contact, and he and I share similar interests. He did he's working on a PhD at Berkeley in comparative literature, and we've had this kind of friendship ourselves now. But it's I've never met him personally, but it's kind of fun to get to know the son of the guy that Hugh wrote to.
Is there any more detail about the conversation he had with his German fiance about Germany and the war?
I wish there were, and I'm hoping while I'm here at Claremont to do a little look in the library. I never made it to Claremont while I was here. I did make some phone calls and didn't find much. Herta Pauli taught here for quite a while. She ended up going to Hawaii and taught in Hawaii for a while, where she died in 1990. So I know a little bit about her. Evidently, she was extremely extravagant and flamboyant and very entertaining, and a lot of people really loved her as a professor.
So you might be able to find some writings or views that she expressed, not necessarily you.
Yeah, it's hard to tell sometimes. Hugh was prone to a bit of hyperbole, so when he says somebody was a Nazi, you're not always sure, but she was German. She was a German emigre, so...
Yeah. Is there coming back here after the war?
After the war, I don't think he really knew what to do after the war. The war was a very devastating experience for him, and he spent quite a bit of time recovering in southern Utah after the war. Southern Utah became a real kind of touchstone for him in terms of his just emotional health. And so he spent a lot of time there and then went up to Salt Lake, started working for the Improvement Era, and just kind of fell into the job at BYU. John A. Widsoe evidently kind of considered himself the person to find the next generation of scholars. It was kind of his personal thing, you know. And he told Hugh to apply to BYU, and I think Hugh saw that as kind of a mandate from the brethren. So he applied. The letter of recommendation that he wrote to then-President McDonald at BYU was very flattering. It was a very kind recommendation, but at the bottom of it, Elder Widsoe wrote, I think we must retain this man for our purposes. He may come in handy. Very kind of interesting little note. So he kind of just fell into that job. He never said whether he thought of coming back or not, but I think he had a great deal of soul-searching after the war. It was pretty... Being attached to the 101st, he really saw a lot of gruesome stuff. In the war? He was attached. He spent a year in training, which is kind of... typical government, I guess. They didn't catch on that he had all this language skills until very late, and so he actually did weather service school and air traffic control stuff for the first part of his training, and then they got him into military intelligence. He went over to England, assigned to the European Theater, and prepared for D-Day, working in the British War Office, and then... On D-Day, he landed a jeep on Utah Beach, spent some time there, back to England, landed in Holland, was involved in the 70-day mess in Holland, then was at the breakout at Bastogne, near Bastogne when the breakout occurred, and then was transferred back into Paris, and attached to Patton's army group for a while at the end of the war. So he really saw firsthand. I mean, I think his war experience is a fascinating period, and my brother-in-law actually, I treat it in the book, but my brother-in-law's got a book coming out this summer just talking about the war experiences in detail. And I think his perspective is really interesting because on the one hand, he, as an order of battle man, he got the big picture. He had to know where the troops were and what the disposition, where they were, and everything. But attached to the 101st, he saw it up close and personal too. So I think he got a really interesting view of World War II. That's quite interesting. Yeah, which he didn't enjoy, by the way. Yeah. They lived in California down in Glendale. That's where they were at the end. Hugh was born in Portland, Oregon. They lived there. Then they lived in Medford. Then they went back to Portland. Then they came down to California. They lived in the L.A. area for a while. Then the big house was in the Glendale area. And then after that house was sold, his mother was in the Hollywood ward.
I think they lived in the same ward estate with LeGrand Richards.
They did. They were close family friends with LeGrand Richards.
The Collister family is still there that are descended from the Randers.
Yeah.
How big was his family and when did he come?
Hugh actually didn't marry until he got to BYU. And so I'll take the last question first. He He came to BYU, that was 1946 when he started teaching at BYU, and he was still single, and he got a great deal of pressure from President Elder Widsoe to get married. You know, you're not supposed to be your threat to menace to society, I guess, if you're a single man. And so he told him, you know, hey, I'll marry the first woman I meet at BYU, and he did. It's a fascinating little story. And then what was the other question? His brothers and sisters. He had an older brother, Sloan. Then there was Reed, Philip, who died at a young age. Richard, who I never met. He died of Lou Gehrig's disease before I, at a later age, but he was a wonderful man. Yeah, he played the violin. Reed was younger, and then Barbara was the youngest. Barbara just had her 80th birthday. It was Sloan, Hugh, Richard, Reed, Barbara. Philip was in there too, but I don't remember where. Philip was just older than Reed.
And who's alive? Just Barbara?
Barbara and Reed are still alive, yeah.
Was the only time he really considered venturing out for the BYU was that one time when he was considering going to the University of Utah?
He actually also considered going to Clarion College in Pennsylvania. They made him an offer. You know, it always kind of came down to what do they want me to do for Hugh. He seemed to really depend on that, being the general authorities. And they would tend to give him kind of oblique answers, you know, make your own decision up. President Clark, who was in the first presidency at the time, J. Reuben Clark, when he was thinking about going to the U, he said, you know, hey, you make your choice, but you probably won't be able to talk about the church as much there. And Hugh took that to mean stay at BYU. When he also was thinking of staying at Berkeley. He did a sabbatical at Berkeley, and Hugh writes that he was offered a position. And I've got a letter that he wrote to President Joseph Fielding Smith saying, what do you think about this? And the letter came back from Joseph Fielding Smith saying, you have to make your own decision, but we'd hate to lose you. And that was enough. He stayed at BYU. Clarion College, he was thinking about going there, but that was when the Joseph Smith papyri came out, and I think he was happy. He was giddy as a kid to have that little opportunity. So I think he didn't want to lose that chance. So. Yeah, that was in the mid-60s.
Okay, we probably should.
Yeah, we need to make it.
Time for the next session.
Thank you.
If you have any more questions, I think we'll be around.